Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is Monday, September 29th, and holy cow, every week I come in and I say that it's been the most amazing week in the world of politics or the economy or whatever, and we've had another chart topper, another amazing week. It boggles the mind, and some would say my mind is easily boggled, but it isn't just that. So September 29th was an interesting day in history. This was the day that the first woman officiated a heavyweight title boxing match. Now, those of you who know history, do you know when this happened? Okay. It was carried on NBC, and Muhammad Ali defeated Ernie Shavers. Ernie Shavers, you're saying? Wasn't he an old TV star? No, that was Ernie Kovacs. But this was 1977 that the first woman officiated a heavyweight match. Kind of amazing, really, because long before we had the first woman vice presidential candidate, which was not Sarah Palin, as you probably know. It was, wait for it, Geraldine Ferraro, as you probably know. Anyway, the other thing on this day in 1982, oh, I shouldn't have given you a year yet, we had the Tylenol scare. It wasn't just a scare. Seven people died after taking extra strength Tylenol, mostly in the Chicago area. It was laced with cyanide, and they recalled their Tylenol product. And actually, this was kind of the beginning, at least in my memory banks. You folks that listen regularly know that I teach at the Department of Communication at George Mason, and I've been teaching communication for more than 20 years in various departments around the world, country. And PR is a part of the field of communication. And one of the newest areas of PR in the last 20 years is basically crisis management. And the Tylenol case was one of the earliest cases of crisis management because they had the possibility that their brand could disappear completely. Now, it didn't come to that, fortunately, but, you know, it could have. One of the things that happens with a brand is that one misstep can really just totally, totally screw you. So what happened with, for example, Schlitz Beer. Schlitz Beer was a leading brand in the U.S. in the 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And sometime in the 80s, early 90s, I think it was in the late 80s, people at Schlitz, it was bought by somebody, and they tried to cut costs, and they tinkered with the process. And they ruined the beer. They shipped out hundreds of thousands of cases that had sediment in it or film on it or something. And people opened it up and it was garbage. And the Schlitz brand went right down the tubes. They actually withdrew it from the market. In fact, it's only emerged in the last couple of years. They've actually started selling Schlitz again. They used to bill it as Schlitz, the beer that made Milwaukee famous. But I say it was the beer that made crisis management famous because they didn't manage that crisis and the brand disappeared. Tylenol, which happened on this day, September 29th, in 82, Tylenol managed to do better. Tylenol recovered from that. Well, let's move on to a few things that are going on in the world. One of the things going on in the world is the Redskins beat the hated Cowboys yesterday in Dallas in a close game. Huge, huge game, a big upset. And a satisfying victory. And Jim Zorn is looking like a heck of a coach, and Jason Campbell's looking like a heck of a quarterback. They're 3-1, and we'll see if it holds up. But the biggest news of all, of course, we're going to deal with some of the lighter stuff. I say by lighter, I mean miscellaneous stuff here for a few minutes. But we have the bailout bill, and I expected to come in tonight and talk about the debate from last Friday night and the fact that the bailout was on the road to being passed. And then, amazing wonders of wonders, today the House of Representatives failed to pass the bailout bill that everyone says is needed to avert a crisis, in fact, a depression, another Great Depression. So fingers start pointing immediately, and the Democrats, Republicans first blamed the Democrats, which told you that they were at fault, and then the Democrats piled on and blamed the Republicans. And McCain blamed Obama, and Obama, cool cucumber that he is, said, we need to work on this together, and he refused to blame anybody, which was actually kind of cool. So we will get to the bailout, and really, I was going to go through the details of the bailout and explain to my audience in somewhat simplified terms what I understand about what they'd agreed to. But there's no point now, because they're not even going to vote on it again. The Senate's not taking it up on Wednesday. They're going to take a couple days off here for Rosh Hashanah, and Barney Frank isn't going to be around, so everything comes to a halt at the Capitol. That's not true. There'll be some negotiations, but they're not even bringing Congress back in session till Thursday. But they're all supposed to be home working on the election. And so that isn't going to happen. Congress is staying in town until we get this fixed. And as I recall, John McCain suspended his campaign until this was... Oh, no, he has unsuspended his campaign, even though it's not fixed. I wonder how that works, how you do that. He didn't consult me. Okay, so let's go on to some miscellaneous things. Now, this is really miscellaneous. The Mint is coming out next year with four new Lincoln head pennies. The front side staying the same, but they have got four new backsides, as it were. And one of them shows Lincoln a log cabin. One of them shows him as a, what do you call him? Was he a rail splitter in Indiana? One of them shows him as an Illinois state senator. They show him standing outside the state senate. And one of them shows a half-built capital, which symbolizes him preserving the onion. And so those are coming out next year on President's Day. Now, we no longer celebrate Lincoln's birthday. Do you remember when Lincoln's birthday is? You know, grammar school kids, when I was growing up, and for 10 or 20 years after that, all knew Lincoln's birthday and Washington's birthday because they were both celebrated, although only one of them was a holiday, Washington's. They then combined them and put in, called it President's Day, and celebrated near Washington's birthday. But holidays used to be celebrated on the actual day, so you knew when they were. Now they're celebrated on a Monday, and I'll bet, like if I were to go to my students, they're a bunch of 18-year-olds, I'll bet they do not know Abraham Lincoln's birth date or George Washington's. Even the day and the month, I'm not even talking the year. So, and I don't know, I know the year, except that the penny is tied to his year. So February 12th is Lincoln's birthday, and February 22nd is Washington's birthday, but we now mix them together and celebrate it in between on a Monday. And that's why kids today don't know those. In terms of the year, they're coming out with this in 2009 because Lincoln was born 200 years ago. And he was born in 1809 on February 12th. And 100 years ago, they came out with the Lincoln penny. It used to be the Indian head penny, and in 1909, they switched. And if you are a coin collector, you know that in 1909, a man by the name of Victor D. Brenner designed the penny, and his initials appeared on the 1909 penny. And so, not all of them, actually, on some of them. And so I actually have in my coin collection, and I don't keep up an active coin collection, but I saved some of my old coins, the pennies I didn't spend, you know, the quarters and half dollars I probably spent when I was a kid. But I saved the pennies, and I had a 1909 VDB penny, a Victor D. Brenner penny. The initials are there, clear as day, on the backside at the bottom. And there was that. Now, that's not the most valuable penny. I'll get off this in a minute for those of you who are not into coin collecting. But the 1909 SVDB is the really valuable one. Those were minted at the Sacramento Mint. Most of them, rest of them were at the Denver Mint or Philadelphia Mint. And the Sacramento Mint came with an S on them. The Denver Mint came with a D on them, I think. And then the Philadelphia Mint didn't have anything on them. Anyway, the 1909 SVDB is the most valuable Lincoln head cent ever minted. Next year, we're coming out with new ones. Now, here's some interesting facts about pennies, though. And this has nothing to do with coin collecting. Did you know that we now spend more to make a penny than a penny is worth? The U.S. government spends 1.4 cents to make a one-cent coin. Right? Part of it's the cost of copper, but part of it's just the cost of striking these, because they've mixed copper and zinc together. If they now had, if it was only copper, they would have disappeared. I mean, people would just take the pennies and melt them down for the copper, I suppose. But they're zinc and copper together. But basically, we have $36 million worth of pennies that we produced so far this year in 2008, but we spent over $50 million to make them because they're 1.4 cents apiece. And guess how many? Think about this. How many pennies do you think we've distributed, minted and distributed so far this year? Don't think millions, think billions. 3.6 billion pennies so far this year. Okay. And that's ridiculous because you go into a store and you see the little dishes at the 7-Eleven that say, need a penny, take a penny. Have a penny, give a penny. We don't even need them anymore. People have suggested we switch to value everything by the nickel and there's no pennies. Take them out of circulation. You know, there's something to be said for that, not messing with pennies. People don't really want them. They have to roll them up. We spend a lot of time and energy collecting them and dealing with them. I suppose kids might like them, little kids. And the government is looking at the cost of pennies, and they're thinking of switching again, and they're thinking of switching back to steel. You say, back to steel? Do you remember when there were steel pennies? There was only one year that the United States minted steel pennies. Do you remember what year that was? Can you guess what it might have been? 1943, because steel pennies, copper was very valuable, and in the middle of World War II, they couldn't waste the copper on pennies, so they came out with steel pennies, and they were all a white color. Now, when I was a kid and I started coin collecting, the way we would do coin collecting is we'd go to the bank with my mom, and however much money I had, if I had $10, I'd get, two rolls of pennies. A roll of penny, two rolls of nickels, and a roll of dimes. And that'd be $10. And if I had another $10, I'd get a roll of quarters. And I'd take them home, and I'd look through them for coins I didn't have, years I didn't have in my coin collection, and then roll them up and take them back and get more. And that's how we did it. But at the time, I'd say every roll of pennies might have had an average of one steel penny. From 1943, because again, keep in mind, this would have been about 56, between 56 and 62. I was probably collecting coins between the age of 6 and 12. And, you know, that was only 22 to 30 years beyond the day that the steel pennies came out. It'd be like today looking for 1980 pennies. They're around, you know. So steel pennies were pretty common. Well, we took everyone out of circulation we could. I probably collected 100, 150 of them. And when I got rid of my coin collection, or at some point, I gave them to my cousin Pat, who had a collection also of them. And I don't know if he ever held on to them. But they're thinking of bringing the steel penny back, which would be interesting. And this year, we will probably make over 7 billion pennies. I'm not sure we need that, but we'll see. Politically, we don't have the will to get rid of it. There's great sentiment around the coin. And people like it, apparently. So we'll see. But enough on pennies. When we come back, I want to say a few words about Mr. Paul Newman, who passed away last Friday. And then we'll move on to more serious fare. Hi, I'm Andy Finn. You know, even if someone handed me $1 million this morning,
I'd still be doing my radio show on WEBR. Why? Because I have commitment. I have dedication. Plus, I signed a contract. Now, if you'll do the same, I'll have one more dedicated listener. Don't worry, you can void your contract if I ever get obsessed with liberals or gays, the flag, the pledge, embryonic stem cells, the UN, illegal immigrants, missing white women, or the country of France. So tune in the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, Mondays at 10 p.m. Hey, if you had $1 million, you could buy a radio station.
It is so true. You could buy a radio station, and yet here we are on WEBR, and happy to be here we are. So it is September 29th, and it was on this date in 1829 that Scotland Yard was formed. It's also the birthday of Horatio Nelson, Lord Nelson, 1758, and Bum Phillips, 1923. Now, if you're thinking, Bum Phillips, who was Bum Phillips? He wore a big 10-gallon hat, and he used to be the coach on the sidelines of the Houston Oilers, among other teams. So let's move on to Paul Newman. So Paul Newman died this past weekend, and what a great guy. You know, one of the great things about being an actor is nobody dislikes you. Now, if you get political, I suppose they do. There are plenty of people that dislike different actors. But one of the likable things about Paul Newman is he never hung out on the Washington scene. I don't mean Washington, whack, a little bit of a Freudian slip there, on the Hollywood scene. Paul Newman was the kind of guy that wanted to go home at night to his family, and he did not seek the limelight. He just happened to be an actor and a famous one and a really good-looking guy with blue eyes that women loved. So Newman died at the age of 83, I think it was, this past weekend, and he was nominated more than 10 times for Academy Awards, mostly Best Actor Awards. He won for The Color of Money when he reprised his role as, I want to say Eddie Money, but basically as the hard-driving pool player that he played in The Hustler. And it was Eddie something. I can't think what his stage name was in that movie. I should know that. But his more famous movies were movies like Cool Hand Luke, The Verdict, Absence of Malice. And, you know, he played these loners and losers and people who, you know, were flawed characters, hard drinkers a lot of times. And but just was an amazing guy, because in addition to his acting career, he had two other careers or sidelines. One is that he was a race car driver. And, you know, when he first got into race car driving, I remember this. I thought, oh, this is another, you know, actor just dabbling in this. Turns out he was pretty serious and pretty good at it. I think it was, I don't know what year it was, 79 or something. He actually finished second with two other drivers in the Le Mans race. Now, Le Mans is a 24-hour race, so you can't do it by yourself. You have to have at least two drivers. I think maybe you have to have three. And, in fact, he did a movie on auto racing after that. It was called Winning. Came out in the late 60s. Oh, actually, so it couldn't have been 79 he did this. It had to be early 60s he did this, I guess. No, it was 79 he won the race, I think. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He did the race about it first. So an amazing guy. And then, of course, he had Newman's Own. You can still go into the store and buy popcorn or salad dressing with Paul Newman on the bottle. And he never took a dime of that for himself. He donated all that money to charity. He raised over $250 million so far for charity from putting his name on these products. And he has a whole slew of those products. You see them when you go in the grocery store. So the cool thing about that is this. I've talked before on this show a lot about people that ride the wave of celebrity. You know, anybody that can get hold of the tail of the media giant will do it. and just ride it for all it's worth. And as long as you stay famous, you can make money. And then when your time is passed, they let you know by not calling you anymore, not putting you on TV or on radio or on CD or whatever your medium is, you're done. So people go for that fame and they ride the wave as far as they can. And they usually get as much money or fame or accolades or whatever they can out of it, the high life, as they say. Paul Newman took that celebrity, as a few people do, and said, I'm going to use this for something good. You know, and this is where I have an agreement with somebody like Laura Ingraham, who's, you know, of course, she's totally political. But Laura Ingraham, a right-wing talk show host on has a morning show that's pretty successful. She's one of the top 10 talk show hosts in the country. And she wrote a book, I think it's the only book she's written, called Shut Up and Sing. And her point is that she doesn't like hearing from liberal actors that go out there and spout off about politics. She'd rather you didn't use your celebrity to further a cause. Well, I understand if she's a conservative, she might feel that way. But you have to distinguish between people who just get up and say stupid things and people who actually use their celebrity for something good. Because otherwise, all you're using your celebrity for is to make money and you cash in your fame in to add to your wealth. So somebody like Bono of U2 comes along, and in addition to being a rock star, he gets interested in helping the people of Africa. And he has leveraged his fame in unbelievable ways and done a tremendous amount of good. You know, Angelina Jolie has chosen to do a lot of this personally. That is, she's adopted several children from the third world. You know, you can't adopt them all, but that's a personal connection that most of us don't have. John McCain did the same thing. He and his wife adopted a baby from Bangladesh 20 years ago, 17 years ago. That girl's, I think she might be in college already. So that's a personal connection. But, of course, Angelina Jolie and now her husband, old what's-his-name there, are both heavily involved in charities. She's a UN ambassador, and she lends her names to other things. I think that's a wonderful use of stardom when you consider that the alternative is to go on TV and do ads, and when they're tired of you doing ads and they don't want you anymore, or they don't want you in Japan or Europe for ads, you do infomercials, right? I think this is a wonderful use. So Paul Newman's at the top of this because he has donated $250 million so far from Newman's own products. And I love the story he told that kept his humor in place. He keeps a letter. He used to keep a letter in his office bathroom that came from a fan. And the fan was a fan of his tomato sauce. The guy didn't know who Newman was, except he liked his tomato sauce. So he wrote a letter and said, my girlfriend mentioned that you were a movie star, and I would be interested to know what movies you have made. If you act as well as you can cook, your movies should be worth watching. So Paul Newman has left us at age 83, but we're richer for it. Okay, let me see if I can summarize a few other stories that aren't getting no press because of the debate last week, the political campaign, and the economic meltdown that now we got a congressional meltdown that we're still in the middle of. There is piracy on the high seas. So there are pirates operating off the coast of Somalia and in the Gulf of Aden between Somalia and Yemen. They have made many, many attacks in the last couple of years. They are bold as brass, as one of my grammar school teachers used to say about us kids. And they go onto a ship that, you know, there's only 20 crew members on a freighter that's carrying some kind of cargo. They go on, they board it with weapons, you know, automatic weapons. They only need 20 guys in a sailboat or a skiff. And they take it over, and they hold it for ransom. They get $1 million, and they leave. You'd think you could wipe these guys out. We managed to wipe out the Barbary pirates, but they've been doing this for a while. Well, it's getting serious. So both the Russian Navy and the U.S. Navy are now involved. And interestingly, a Russian ship, or actually it was a different kind of ship, but it had Russian weapons on it. It has something like 23 tanks, Russian tanks on it, and a whole bunch of other weapons and ammo. Huge cache of lethal weapons. And it was just taken over last week by Somali pirates. And so the Americans are there with their warships, the Russians are there, and they're threatening to kill all the hostages, all the crew, if they don't get their way. But there's no way we're letting them off with that ship. They may get $1 million, and I think then we'll probably blow them out of the water once they get in their boats, because I don't see how they get away unless they take hostages with them. But we got to get serious about this piracy thing. This is nonsense that pirates on the high seas are bugging us. And let's see. Well, Ted Stevens is on trial. His trial has started in Washington. Of course, he is the senator from Alaska who has been in power a long time until the Republicans were unseated. He was chair of the Ways and Means Committee, I think it is, which is responsible for allocations of money. Therefore, he was very powerful, and he steered billions, that is not millions, billions of dollars in pork barrel spending home to Alaska. That's where Alaska got its reputation for pork. It's how Sarah Palin was able to bring millions of dollars of pork and earmarks to her little town of Wasilla. And Alaska, you know, what's interesting about Alaska is they have this reputation up there. They fancy themselves as these rugged individualists at the last frontier. And yet, they take more pork than any state in the Union. Now, admittedly, it's more of a wilderness, so they need more roads built and bridges built and things like that. And they've got an unforgiving climate, so things have to be rebuilt. But it's just interesting that the rugged individualists are feeding at the trough at a higher rate than those of us back east or even in the heartland. And let's see, in the last few months, the U.S. government has made public the grand jury testimony of witnesses who are dead or who consented to have their grand jury testimony made public from, hold your breath, the espionage case from the 1950s of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Now, this happened before I was paying attention to the news. I was 3 years old when they executed him, but they are the last two people in America to be executed for espionage. And I've never quite understood all the evidence about it and whether they were both guilty, et cetera, because they had fierce defenders that said they weren't guilty and the government said they were. It turns out their sons have come out and, having looked at this evidence, say, okay, we always thought Dad was innocent and Mom. It turns out Dad was guilty. That's clear from the trial transcripts. Mom was innocent and she got framed. And we fried an innocent woman, but, of course, her husband was in it up to his neck. And let's see. Oh, so these are the stories we missed in the last week because of all the turmoil in the markets and the financial meltdown and Congress dealing with this and the debate, etc. It turns out that top officials at the White House knew in early 2002 about the harsh interrogation techniques being used by the CIA to extract information from suspected terrorists in the secret prisons that we didn't know about for about 5 years. And Condi Rice knew, a bunch of people knew. So that came out, and I'm not going into that in any detail. A prosecutor at Guantanamo quit because he says evidence was withheld from the defense and he cannot in good conscience continue to prosecute. Keep in mind, these are guys in the service, U.S. soldiers, U.S. military, saying the process is unfair. We're leaving. We don't have time to discuss that. Neither does the country. The Iraqi parliament approved the election law in Iraq. There's some progress on the political front in Iraq. We don't have time to talk about that, and the country doesn't have time to talk about that. Oh, and an Air Force instructor came out and a colonel discussed with a Senate panel how the U.S. training program was adapted to provide harsh interrogation techniques of Iraqi detainees. And he was just amazed that it morphed into a form of punishment for people who wouldn't cooperate. And what he basically said was that we adapted these from the torture method used by the Chinese communists, but they were never regarded as useful techniques for eliciting intelligence. The Chinese used them to break a prisoner psychologically and get them to eager to say anything to stop the pain. So they weren't looking for intelligence. They were looking for any kind of a confession to get propaganda values. They didn't care if the guy told the truth or not. They were looking for propaganda, not intelligence. And those are the techniques that we have taken, the Bush administration has taken, I shouldn't say we, has taken and used and thought they would get useful information about. Need I say more? Well, I probably do need to say more, but I'm not going to. Instead, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are going to move on to the financial situation and the election.